I thought I'd read you a couple little articles that I found recently. They are, you know, studies, analytical studies. Why millennials are lonely. This is from Forbes Online. One reason the internet makes us lonely is we attempt to substitute real relationships with online ones. Though we temporarily feel better when we engage others virtually, these connections tend to be superficial and ultimately dissatisfying. Online social contacts are not an effective alternative for offline social interaction, sums one study. In fact, the very presence of technology can hinder genuine offline connections. Simply having a phone nearby caused pairs of strangers to rate their conversation as less meaningful, their conversation partner as less empathetic, and their new relationship as less close than strangers with a notebook nearby. Excessive internet use also increases feelings of loneliness because it disconnects us from the real world. Research shows that lonely people use the internet to feel totally absorbed online, a state that inevitably subtracts time and energy that could otherwise be spent on social activities and building more meaningful, more fulfilling offline friendships. In his controversial 1970 book, The Pursuit of Loneliness, sociologist Philip Slater coined the toilet assumption. Our belief that undesirable feelings and social realities will simply disappear if we ignore them. Slater argued that America's individualism, and in turn our loneliness, is rooted in the attempt to deny the reality of human interdependence. The internet is perhaps the best example to date of our futile attempt to flush away loneliness. Amen. 1,000,000,000 times. I couldn't agree more. I would like to write a gigantic book on this very topic. I believe that in many ways, Facebook, social media, texting, and the smartphone is incredibly destructive to your marriage, to your friendship with your children, to our Christian fellowship with one another. We are in a permanent state of distraction. And in fact, studies have shown, and Mark Darling does not make this stuff up, you think I exaggerate, you're really wrong. I do my homework. I gather the studies. It's as dangerous as drunk driving. I pray over my wife every day she leaves. She's been putting on a lot more miles because she's going to help with about 3 or 4 times a week with different grandchildren, give the mom a break. And the fools that are driving with that phone every day, looking at it, I have to honk at them because they won't go in the light screen because they're looking at their phone. They're driving. They're swerving out of your way. It's dangerous. It's like having a bunch of drunks on the road. That's what the studies say, and that's the reality. It's affecting us. It's come on like an onslaught. One man has coined the term weapons of mass distraction, and that's what's happening. And so unless, that doesn't mean it's all things evil. It helps fulfill a lot of evil desires. But it also interrupts this incredible thing that we call Christian fellowship and the one another commands if we're not very, very careful and manage it very wisely. And if we don't manage it wisely, it gets in the way. This is another study I got the other day. Is feeling lonely the greatest health problem America faces? While the obesity epidemic has long been front and center in major cities across the U.S., new research finds that loneliness and social isolation is an even greater public health threat than being overweight. Oh, my goodness. Dr. Julianne Holt-Lernsted, a professor of psychology at Brigham Young University, conducted 2 meta-analyses of previous studies to determine how social isolation, loneliness, and living alone plays a role in a person's risk of dying. They're talking about the risk of dying, but we're also talking about tremendous degradation of quality of life. Being connected to others socially is widely considered a fundamental human need. Crucial to both well-being and survival, extreme examples show infants, and this is true, by the way, extreme examples show infants in custodial care who lack human contact fail to thrive and most often die. Years ago, some of these studies happened by accident. After wars, all the babies, all the orphans, so they'd try to offer care. Some of this stuff happened during World War II. Some of it's very unpleasant to read. And they had all these children, and some of them decided to even experiment. And so these children would just get a bottle held in their mouth and a diaper changed, and that was it. And in a whole other room, they would pay more attention. They would stroke the baby, physically touch the baby. Almost every baby in this room died, even though they had their food and their diapers changed. And they discovered that human touch and human interaction is vital for human life. And God knows this. This is why the early church was devoted to fellowship. It's why family is so important. In fact, social isolation and solitary confinement have been used as a form of punishment, says Holt Lunstead in an American Psychology Association press release. Yet an increasing portion of the U.S. population now experiences isolation regularly. In an analysis of 148 studies that included more than 300,000 people, that's what we mean by meta-analysis, no 50 people in a room here, 300,000 people total. Her research team found that a greater social connection cuts a person's risk of early death by 50%. So, I just want to give us a baseline. Now, I want to give you a couple observations, and then we'll get into the meat of this. You may disagree with my observations, but before you form an opinion, I would like you to just hear me out, okay? you're going to think this sounds a little tacky. I want to talk in this section about loving better. How can we love one another better? And we're especially going to talk about compassion and empathy towards one another in our relationships. And then we'll have a little exercise for you to do later, a real life one, a real world one. And I hope that you'll participate because it'll take a lot of honesty to participate. Here is what I'm observing in the culture I live in. Bear with me as I share this. And just try to let your mind go for a moment of preconceived ideas that you might have about what I'm going to say. Without realizing it, I believe, particularly in America, but I see this when I travel, particularly in some of our farther advanced Western countries like Germany or France or Britain. Without realizing it, we have come to value the fake over the real and genuine. And I'm going to give you some illustrations. So, let me go back. When Pat was here, he asked you to read the chapter of a book that he handed out. I forget the name of the book, but it was, you know, some guy wrote it. He knows the guy. He's gone to his seminars. You remember that chapter? If some of you read it, if you remember back. One of the statements the guy made, he made this statement, and again, I bless the man's heart. He's a dear man, and I'm sure he meant well, but I just rolled my eyes. Was that if only our churches, and we really loved one another in this way where we grieved with those who grieve, and we... The world will beat a path to our door. No, they won't. No, they won't. That's a lie. That's not. You're deceived if you think that. In fact, so here I'm going to illustrate with you why. I'm going to prove it to you. We love the fake more than we like the real. The porn epidemic. Millions prefer fake instant gratification over a real, meaningful, yet at times very complicated relationship with a living spouse. Porn is easier, and it's fake. It's fake, but it's easier, and it's fast, and it's quick, and it's all this variety, and it's a lot more accessible, and we have an epidemic in our nation because we like what's fake. Number two, I'll prove it to you again. We see this that Americans prefer fake food, quick, easy meals, pre-boxed junk, full of preservatives and bad things, than to spend time, a little extra time, to make something real, nutritious, and satisfying. We would rather grab a box of junk than go get an apple, cut up that apple, wash it, and then eat it. I see this all the time, and we're dying. I'm telling you one of the reasons. 63% of all illnesses in the world are the result of lifestyle decisions. And in America, the two main contributors are our terrible diets, that means food, and our sedentary lifestyle. We are killing ourselves. You know why? Because we've been conditioned to like what's fake. I'll never forget when Kathy's father, my wife's father, he was vice president of Quick Trip. So like Quick Trip, Quick Shop for a long time, and he was into groceries and stores, and he would go in, and I'll never forget, in the early 80s, so Kathy and I had been married, and one day we were sitting around, and he said, you know the next big thing in grocery stores, Mark and Kathy? And I'm like, I guess he'd know the next big thing in grocery stores is going to be all pre-prepared meals, the delis, everything. Women, they don't want to cook anymore. And people don't understand that one of the greatest detriments to children's health and the way we've conditioned is that now almost everyone's a double income. We do it fast, we do it ready, and the food, it does bad things to you. And I could tell you study after study after study. This is not Mark blowing on a little health trip. I'm telling you, we like stuff fake because it's quick, it's fast, and boom, then the real thing. Now, let's get to relationships. Relationships. I see this, but we see it in the exponential expansion of social media addiction that allows us to have many shallow, superficial friends or shallow, quick conversations rather than deep, meaningful connections to others that are close to us. We spend an inordinate amount of time on shallow, relatively small amount of time on building deeper, more meaningful, emotionally deep, connected relationships. We have been conditioned to value quick, easy, and convenient over more important things and values. That's reality. Listen, what Facebook has been doing to you, and you may not realize it, is it's just the same kind of, as Jeremy's been sharing about the porn epidemic, it's the same dopamine hit to you when you get all those likes on your photo or your cool little comment or your cutesy comment that men get from porn. And the study after study are finding that the addiction that people are dealing with is as deep as that to crack cocaine. Now, the difference, of course, is crack cocaine really affects you also physically. It's bad. The phone's not quite the same. But the dopamine, the addiction is the same. And so what I find happening with young people is these just, oh, I feel good about myself because people said something good to me today, but it's just quick, it's just easy. And by the way, often our Facebook life is our fake book life. And this is one of the ways I know it. So I'm a pastor. I pastor people. I know not everyone, but lots of people in my congregation. I know the backstory. I know their life. I know what they're going through. And yet sometimes I will go to their Facebook. Oh, man, life is great. Oh, look at me. I'm enjoying this. And I'm thinking, you just called me yesterday, and your whole world is falling apart. There's a disconnect, isn't there? A disconnect because, well, we don't share that part of ourselves on Facebook. Now, again, don't take me wrong. You have one, great. Use it. If you find a way to use it, use it. But here's what I know. The time that we're... I was talking to a young man one time, not too long ago, trying to help this young man. The average young person today receives 150 texts a day. They send about another 150, so about 300 a day. But even if it's 150, if you're up for 15 hours, that's 10 an hour, or 15 an hour. That means about every 5 minutes, you're getting interrupted in your day. It's hard to concentrate. If you're trying to have a conversation with your wife or your children, have something meaningful, and you're constantly distracted, and you cannot go deep. It's like trying to be intimate with your life, your wife, and make love, and every 5 minutes, the little thing's buzzing. You're like, oh, I'm distracted. Oh, I'm distracted. That ain't going to work. Ain't going to work. So, we got to figure out our ways to build margin. We got to understand first what we're dealing with so that we can learn to go deep. Am I making sense? Nod your head if you follow what I'm saying, okay? So you got to understand that this is all of a sudden, right now, 85% of Americans have one. That's 8.5 out of 10. They have a smartphone. Only 5 to 8 years ago, it was about 2 to 3 out of every 10. It's changed everything. And it's changing our ability to concentrate. And you've got to be able, if you're going to do the things we're talking about here today, have deep conversation, then you have to be able to concentrate and put others' interests first. And by the way, this is what the Bible means in Romans. Have you ever seen this verse, never slacking in interest? Let love be sincere, love what is good, never slacking in interest. You know what that means? Stay interested. Stay interested in your wife. Stay interested in your husband. Stay engaged. And everything in the world wants us to disengage. And when I'm not paying attention, I miss the cues that happen in a relationship that go, oh, they need empathy right now. Oh, they need understanding. Oh, my gosh, they're really going through something hard. And so you can find that in a marriage or in friendships, your friends get the distinct signal they can't really go deep with you because you're always distracted, which means another way to say it is, you're not a good listener. And of course, what we learn from God is if he's our refuge and if we're to dump on him, God is a really good listener. He's engaged. He's like, oh, okay, Mark, wait. I got to deal with the little nutcase in North Korea for a moment. Okay, come back. No, wait a minute. Brent's calling me right now. I got to go over here to Brent. Just a minute, Mark. Man, I can't believe what so-and-so just tweeted. We got to deal with that over here. Oh, my gosh, the Iraqis are going crazy. What do we got to do with ISIS? God is not distracted. You are, when you're with God, as if you're the only individual in the universe and you have God all to yourself. I want to imitate that with people. It's a struggle. I want to imitate that with people. I want them to know, you got my eyes, you got my heart, you got, I'm here. I'm in this moment with you. This is vital if we're going to minister to one another and experience it. I see this guy's men, especially with fathers and their kids. Oh, my gosh, isn't it? It's just, my oldest grandson is 10. I have a picture of him in our bedroom. He's just a little guy. I'm like, he's 10. I said to Kathy, 6 years he'll be driving. And in 8 years he'll be in college. He might join the military. He loves the military. We got some guys in the military. He wants to join the Air Force. And I'm like, next thing I know, I'm going to blink. He's there. Time really does fly. It really does fly. And so I want to be in the moments, you see. The Bible commands us to love one another like Christ loved us. Love, in fact, is the central theme, at least one of the central themes of the New Testament. God's love for us, Christ's love for us, us giving that out to others. We're commanded to excel still more in our love. In other words, we learn to love better. We learn to love more like Christ. Many times we think of love in physical ways, like I can give someone a gift or of money when they're going through a financial trial, and that's good, and it can really be encouraging someone, but it's also one of the easier ways to love. As Christians, we're called by God to be devoted to one another, to pursue fellowship and companionship with each other. We're designed by God to need one another. We're told by God to be tender-hearted, kind, and compassionate to each other. We're to bear each other's burdens and rejoice with those who rejoice and grieve with those who are grieving. This is so meaningful in our lives when these things occur in relationship with each other. I'm going to show you a text in the New Living Translation. Probably you've not read it in a long time. It's one of those hidden gems in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews doesn't get read very often. Listen to this, what it says. Hebrews chapter 13. Just want you to think about this. Don't forget about those who are in prison. He's talking about, the Christians who got thrown in, they're being persecuted. Suffer with them as though you were there yourself. Share the sorrow of those being mistreated as though you feel their pain in your own body. That's what we're going for. That's what we're going for. I'll never forget, I hope this dear sister doesn't mind if I share this story. She's here today. I didn't know if she'd be here today or not. It's my dear friend, Kathy Schaefer. You're a heroic lady, Kathy. Actually, I think you're a heroic lady. Many times they welcome me into their home when I go to Berlin. And I'll never forget their last trip. They went and Jean had to go to the hospital and passed away in Berlin. And I remember I heard it. I just started weeping in my office. I was like, oh, my gosh. Gene loved Berlin. He loved Berlin. He would have stayed there his whole life if he could have. And I thought, oh, my gosh, to be away from your family on the other side of the ocean. And immediately my mind, this is how we learn to work it. I just immediately began to put myself in Kathy's shoes, and I thought of all the difficulty, the pain, and some of her closest people, friends are here, not over on the other side of the ocean. And I thought about all the work it's going to be to get him back here and all that's involved. Well, anyway, so I'm praying for him in my office. And I got an email from, I believe it was Daniel Gehring. And Daniel said, hey, Mark, if you could be around the house later, Kathy wants to call you. And I was so touched. I was like, well, thank you, Lord. I'm honored. She called, and we prayed, and we cried together over the phone, and I just listened, tried to anyway. I remember, though, some days later, or maybe it was later on, maybe it was that day or later that day, you may or may not remember this, Kathy, but I thought it was interesting, because Kathy, she's obviously been involved, knows lots of you here, and she hadn't been up at the Rock. We knew each other from my travels to Berlin, and then years ago when we moved up here. And I remember asking Kathy, I'm just curious, why did you want to talk to me? I'm very honored that you wanted me. And I remember her saying, Mark, because I just knew you'd be compassionate. And after I hung up, it made me weep because I realized, first of all, well, Lord, you changed me, but wow, that's an honor that she feels that way. But I didn't start out this way. Let me tell you how I started out. It's 36 years ago. I want to use this story as an illustration of where my baseline was. I was home one day. We lived in Ames, Iowa at the time, and I lived at Highland Apartments. Never forgot it. It's up on Lincoln Way by the Hy-Vee store, Highland Apartments. It was our second place living after we got married, or third. And little Celeste was learning to swim in the pool. She's about 5 months old. And there was a pastor and his wife in our church that was eventually we became very close. And we did a lot of different things together, music and stuff like that. He was older than I was, but very dear to me and my wife. They had two children at the time, I believe. So one day I had to call him for something we were planning, we were doing. I think it was some big thing we were putting on at C.Y. Stevens to invite people's parents to. And so anyway, I called him on the phone. I said, Don, I called to see if he was there. Well, the wife answered. I said, Sally, I was just wondering if Don's around. No, he's not. And it was kind of that pregnant pause. And I'm about 23 and a half at this time, maybe 24. And I said, how are you today? Well, it's been a really hard day, Mark. We lost our child. I was expecting, it's 6 months, and I had to go in today and have a DNC. For those of you who don't know what a DNC is, like, it's like having an abortion. It was, the baby was dead, still born, but she had to have it like an abortion, which they vacuum the body, and it rips the little baby apart. And it's very, very traumatic. None of that crossed my mind at the time. Not one of those things. So in Mark speak, I just said, well, you know, praise the Lord, he works everything for good. And there was a pause, silence, and I said, I'll just call Don back later. Bye, and I hung up. About 2 hours later, the phone rings. I pick it up. It's Don. I thought he's returning my call. He said, Mark, you got a few minutes? I said, sure, Don. What's up? He goes, I've been trying to console my wife who's been sobbing the last 2 hours. I said, I'm really sorry. What happened? You happened, Mark. I was like, okay. What do you mean? He goes, Mark, my wife had the baby vacuumed out of her womb today. It was kind of like having an abortion. The baby's dead. She lost the baby. And all you had to say was, praise the Lord, he works all things for good. And, was I embarrassed and I was humbled. And I was again reflected to myself, I am not like God. I apologized. I wrote a long letter to her. But it made me realize, Lord, I have a long ways to go to learn what it means to be understanding and thoughtful in the moment when maybe things, obviously, I'm not a woman, see? And so I didn't stop. I didn't ponder what it would be like to be nurturing that little baby in the womb and all the hopes that I have to have another child. In fact, I think what was in the back of my mind, and I didn't say this, I'm embarrassed to say it now because it'll sound horrible, is, you got two. We're good. And there are more eggs, and you'll make love again, and you'll probably have another one. And they did, and they had seven. Whether that's logic or insanity, you can decide. But I understood as I reflected, I was not like God. I was not tender. I was not empathetic. And since that time, of course, God's taken me through the grinder of life and situations. And I've learned some things, and some of them I would like to pass on to you today, of what it means. I'll share with you some real-life stories, changing the names to protect the individual who were involved. But I was very humble. In order to build deeper emotional connections with people that are rich to the soul, loving skills need to be intentionally practiced and developed. Now, again, we start with God, and I go to God, and I've learned a lot. I've got a lot to learn, but I want you to know there's a lot of things I've learned, and they're deep, and I just keep going deeper in them. And I've learned, how do I bring those into my relationship, my reality with people? Sometimes you know what people need from us, if I could put it this way? They need us in the moment to be God to them. I don't know if you've ever thought about that. But they need me now in this moment to be God to them. Maybe they've, you know, I don't, when someone wants to open up to me, and I don't say, well, can I just interrupt? Have you talked this over with the Lord first? Have you emoted to your Savior? Have you experienced the loving comfort and consolation of God? Have you experienced His empathetic understanding? I don't start. I listen to right where they're at. And I think to myself right then, I go, okay, lock in, Mark. Get engaged. You don't know where this ride's going to lead. I don't know what this person has just lived through. I'll never forget another example that happened early on. Just to show you how sometimes we just have no idea what people are going through. So I was 23. It was February of 1980. And we had planned to have my first child, who was Celeste, at home. We'd gone to all the home birth class, and believe me, in those days, they were wild. They were crazy. You were like a hippie, crazy nut. But I figured my wife is a runner. She was tough. She was game for it. We didn't have insurance, so it seemed like a natural thing to do is have a baby at home. It's free and all that. Well, yes, there's a few dangers, but whatever. You know, when you're young, you minimize things. Well, it turns out the little baby's coming out like this. It's called a footling breech. That ain't going to work. Especially at home, that is not going to work. So we have to plan a cesarean. So this is to show you the mark, this young Mark. So I'll never forget this. We were cooking in the sorority at the time. And in those days, you could get boxing on ABC. I love boxing. I grew up around boxing. My father was a boxer. I knew the lingo. I loved it. And so there was, I think it was one of the Ali Frazier fights or Foreman fights. Anyway, so we were cooking in the sorority. She was downstairs, really pregnant. And she's not supposed to go into labor. See, she's not supposed, you got to have this cesarean before you really go into labor. So I'm up in the kitchen preparing stuff, and I'm watching the fight, and I'm moving, and I'm like, oh, come on, kill him! Oh, man! And I'm, you know, talking back to the TV. That's what we grew up doing. And bottom of the steps, Mark! Mark! I go to the steps. What, honey? She says, Mark, they're starting to get really, the contraction's really hard. I said, it's the fifth round. It's a 15-round fight, Kathy. Can you hold on? Okay, I know it's not, I mean, how far are they apart? Well, I don't know. I said, well, just be patient with me, okay? So I go back. I'm watching the fight. Mark! Now we're about the ninth round. Mark! Really, are they about 4 minutes apart? I'm like, well, we still got time, Kathy. Look, this is really close fight, and there's five more rounds to go. She goes back. She comes back finally. It's about round 12. Mark! She's at the bottom of the steps. She's holding her stomach. Mark, if you don't take me now, I'll kill you. I'm like, you better turn it. Darn, I got to turn the fight off. So I turn the fight off, and I get her. We go to the hospital. They wheel her in, right? And you just have to know, no matter how hard I try, there's one area I just can't grow in. I just cannot deal with blood and medical stuff. It just tears me up. I go visit people. I have a different heart, but I can't be in where all the gore is. I get immediately hot, and vomit comes up into my mouth, and So anyway, we go into this surgery room with the bright spotlights, and she's on the little bed, and she really wanted me to come, and I'm like, oh, I think I can do this. And I knew she's not going to labor, so they lay her on the bed. They put this sheet right about where Tommy is, right, her big sheet, and I can't quite see over it. I'm sitting on a stool, and she's holding my hand, and they give her this, the epidural almost put me on the floor. I wasn't supposed to see that part. He comes out with a needle about this long. She's on her side and pushes in her back. I'm like, oh God, help me right now. So I went out, got some fresh air, and I come back. So it's taking a little time, and he's working away, and I'm like, wow, I wonder what's on the other side of that sheet. Ooh, man. So I step up, lean on the stool, you know, and her stomach's outside of her stomach. And there's all this bluishness stuff in this, and I'm like, and I must have started to turn white, literally, because he looks at me, he goes, you blankety blank, sit down right now. Last thing I need in here is your skull broken open on the floor, and I got to deal with her and you at the same time. That's how he said it. Now I'm a first-time dad. This is, We're paying $8,000 for this experience, sir. Why did you talk to me like that? That's what I thought, you know. This was another really humbling lesson in my life. Fortunately, I didn't mouth off. The old Mark, he really would have mouthed off. I just sat back down and realized, don't want to cause you more problems. I'm feeling really sickish. Just look at my wife's face. Hold on to her hand. Forget what I saw. Get it out of your head. Get it out of your head. Pretty soon there'll be a baby. Pretty soon there was. Later on, we got to our room. We're sitting in the room. And the nurse came in and she said, how did it go? I said, well, it was interesting. I was trying to be gracious. I said, the doctor seemed pretty on edge. And she got really quiet. She said, well, Dr. Wall's wife just had their second baby, and she has cancer, and she's going to die at the end of this week. And I almost just fell apart. I'm like, oh, my gosh. Thank you, God. I did not say something. You never know sometimes what the person you're dealing with is going through in their life. And that lesson, I've kept that in my head. I try to keep all these things I go through and put them there and go, okay, draw on that one, Mark. Remember that one, Mark. Remember that one, Mark. People you're dealing with, their lives, they're going through things that you may not know. So the first little lesson I'm going to pass on to you is be present in the moment with people, not distracted and distant. It's a very good idea to put the phone completely away and turned off. I'll tell you another thing. A lot of people call me on the phone. I get emails. Of course, I'm engaged in their email. A lot of times, I find that people are able to share with me far more honestly what they're really dealing with. And I invite them and go, hey, I would love to hear your story. Do you know what that does to someone to say, I'd love to hear your story. If you ever want to write it to me, I'd be glad to read it and I'll get back to you. I've had people from all over the country and some from other parts of the world who have written to me after they wrote me this story, and I got back to them almost usually within the same hour, sometimes within minutes. And they'll write back and go, Mark, I am stunned that you take the time to care to read my story. And I'd write back, and I'll get to that, some of those ways that I do that. Another thing I found is that sometimes in my office, there's a computer right in front of me, right? I get away from that thing. I go on a little, I call it a prayer walk with God. I go into my garage, you know, and I just walk around the van and I listen. I put it on speakerphone so I can hear really good. And I listen. And I let their story, I take a genuine interest in other people, a genuine interest in what's going on in their life. I want to be like God. God's genuinely interested in my life. And again, that's in the back of my mind. How is God? How is God with you, Mark? He's interested all the time, and you can go to him whenever you want. And I want to be that guy. I want them to know. Number two, be attentive, especially when you're in person. Make eye contact and listen with your ears, your heart, your emotions, and your mind. Please, people, men especially, but ladies, don't be afraid to let people get to you emotionally. What would it be like if we went to a God who's just linear only? We get to him emotionally. Do you understand that? That's what it means. A father tenderly has compassion on his child. People got to Jesus emotionally. In fact, even physiologically, because the term literally means compassion, a deep feeling in your gut. You're moved at a gut level. It grabs you. You're there. You understand. I'll never forget, Danny, I won't get into this, but when I heard your story and your sister called me, I got off the phone. I just wept. I could grasp I could put my mind around what you were going through, what was going on, and it was not a day that I did not pray. Pray every day. For your family, what was going on? That's tough trials. Others of you in here, I've done the same when I came to understand. We had to learn, but I want to get to this one. Be tenderhearted. Number three, be tenderhearted, empathetic, compassionate, and understanding. The Bible says in Ephesians 4:32, this is probably the first verse we taught our children, be kind to one another, tenderhearted, soft-hearted. Your heart's easily moved. It can be touched. One insight to empathy and emotional engagement is to remember as they tell their story, recalling a similar situation that I experienced and how I felt myself. It helps me emotionally connect. I'm going to get to another that's even bigger, but that's one thing that's helped me. Let me give you an example. So, do two examples. So, I was, when I was in 7th and 8th grade, I was a really fast runner. I was a fast runner in high school, but there was guys who could run the 100 and 10 flat. I couldn't do 10 flat. I could do the 50-yard dash and 6 flat. I wasn't very big. There was guys bigger than me that could run even faster. So I made a decision, instead of go to football, I'm going to go to music, towards music. But when I was in 7th grade, my hero was the Heisman Trophy winner, O.J. Simpson. I watched him run all the time. I could do a lot of his moves. And so we'd play the 8th graders in scrimmage. I went to this little country school, call it a country school. It was in such and such, Iowa. I won't name the town. In kindergarten through 12th grade, there was about 500 people. And we're all on the same piece of land. But to be honest, I went to most every school day scared. So much so that through much, especially 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th, it stopped probably by 11th and 12th. I have diarrhea almost every day. I got picked on. My name got picked on. But there's this one experience, and I want to explain the psyche of what happened. So I was in 7th grade. We'd scrimmage the 8th graders, and, you know, I could get around. I could just get around the end before they could tackle me, and often I would score. Not always, but often. They hated it. They hated it, and they hated me. And my best friend, Mickey Grimmer, we also played baseball together. He was the quarterback. He could throw really good. He could hand off really good. And if the hole wasn't open in the middle, then I'd just pop to the outside. So one day we had gym class. We had big phys ed class, and I love phys ed. I always got A's in it, but I hated the locker room. I despised the locker room. And I remember we were down on the track, and for whatever reason, you didn't have co-ed in those days, but the girls were having their class on the other end of the track, and we were down by the high jump with the big blue mat where you jump over the bar and you land on padding. And Mickey and I were down there, and we were practicing some stuff, and fell back on the mat, and all of a sudden, 10 eighth grade boys showed up that were all the football players. They grabbed Mickey's shorts, took mine, they tied me up in my jock, and they forced my friend to try to masturbate right there. And I never felt so humiliated in my life. I have since then, by the way, even in pastoring. And I remember I wanted to kill them all. But here's the other thing that happened. See, here's the other thing that was going on, the psychology. I knew that I had the killer instinct my father had. See, my father, when he's about 16 or 17, his dad died when he was 6, and he worked on a railroad. And he worked with a bunch of different people, from ruffians, criminals. And one day, the foreman told my dad, he said, "Oh, Myron, I got to leave the guys here today. I got to leave you here. I won't be. These guys hate your guts. They hate you because you're good looking." My dad was really ripped. He was a fighter. And he said, "So if any of them bother you, take this pickaxe and break it over their head." That's exactly what he told them. As soon as he left, he goes down, these men surrounded him. And one guy, a bigger guy, started to come. My dad didn't think twice. He picked up the pickaxe and broke it. Not the spike, but the wood. Right over the man's head, split his skull open, left him in his own blood. And that was my father. My father had 132 fights and 117 knockouts. Now, I love my father. You have to understand how this affected me as a son. I love my father, but I'm not that guy. And part of me wanted to rip their faces off, but I knew the other thing is, we'll get beat up, we might get thrown up on assault charges, it's a different era, and I also felt humiliated that I couldn't protect my friend from this happening to him. It was all a big ball, you see, wrapped up. I never forgot it. I brought it with me every single day I went to school. I knew then, I wasn't even a Christian, I would never send my kids to school. It started then. I knew I will never, never send them to what we call the public concentration camp. That's where my mind went. I'm not saying that's accurate for everybody. So, about a month ago, maybe it's 2 months ago, one of the things my wife does for me every day is she gives me a back rub. We have this thing, it's called a thumper. You can get them at, they're a great thing, wives, make your husband's day. It's about a 12-minute massage. It's a percussion massager, and it goes like this. She rubs it down my back, down my calves. I have really sore calves all the time, no matter what I stretch, no matter how much magnesium I take, and sore feet, and it really ministers to me. She does it about 12 minutes every day. So this particular day, I was laying on we have a bed that's a little higher. It's a waterbed stand underneath of it, and she was rubbing, and she's rubbing. Sometimes she gets chatty when she's rubbing my back. And she said, "Mark, did you see that story today about the child brides?" you know, with ISIS and all that? And I said, well, you know, I've read about it, honey. She said, well, you know, did you read about that 8-year-old little girl? They let the guy marry her 8-year-old, and he took her home and was intimate with her, and she died from the injuries. So I'm just laying there. Now, as a husband, you're laying there. I have a couple choices I can make. I could have gone, oh, I didn't read that. That's really crazy, isn't it? Hey, could you rub down there on my lower calf there for a moment? So there was something in me. I thought, you know, Kathy doesn't usually bring something up like this. So without skipping a beat, she tells that story. She said, you know, Mark, it brought back a whole lot of memories. I just said, like what, honey? Now, I'm not going to get into the rest of the stories because the rest of the stories have happened since we've been married with some great injustices that Kathy has been through. I just laid there, and tears started to well up in my eyes because I'm taking this all in. See, and I knew, and this is what could happen with couples. See, this is a really big moment in our relationship. It's the moment that men, we can often just miss. And I could have gone, wow, well, honey, praise God he saved you and we've been married and isn't it cool? And say, can you push that right here because this is really hurting right now. And I've been guilty of doing that kind of thing before. So I got up. I don't usually get right up. I usually lay down there for another 10 minutes. So I got up and I just held her. I just gave her a hug. And I said, Kathy, you're just a remarkable woman. I just had no idea. So she said, well, thank you, sweetheart. And thanks for listening. So she laid down and, I laid down. And then I got back up. I went up to my office. And I crafted, it took me about 35 minutes, I crafted a very personal, intimate email to just Kathy, a letter. Call it a letter. I call them letters because my emails aren't usually quick. And I wrote to her what I got from that conversation of the incredible injustices she has had to deal with her life. And yet, if you got around my wife, you would think you're around an angel sometimes. She's so sweet. And I said, Kathy, I cannot tell you how much I admire you. You are a heroic woman. To have gone through those kinds of deeply humiliating, embarrassing, painful, shameful injustices in your life, and no one to talk to, no one seeing her life, this, no one knew. She didn't feel she could go home and tell her family. Those are the kind of moments that can happen in our life, but they're real easy, aren't they, in a relationship. Our mind's on something else. And I'm like, well, honey, is this going to go on much longer? Because I really got to rest. I got to get to an appointment. Or I got to get this done. Or I got to get that done. And we can miss these wonderful opportunities to just allow another human being in our life that we love to share a story they went through. One time, here's another way. I had a young lady right here. I met her in this aisleway of the rock almost 7 or 8 years ago. I remember she came. I wait. Kathy and I sit back right in those two seats under the TV with the armrest, and I hug almost every person that comes in on a Friday night. I get up, greet them, hug the little kids, give them a hug, and sometimes I wait in line just to get a hug. That's the truth. One night, this young person walked in. I don't hug strangers. These are people I know, and I noticed a couple things. I made a couple observations. This young lady tended not to make eye contact. She was very, very, very unusually timid. Not like shy, but like a puppy that's been beat too much. That's exactly what it felt like meeting this young lady. So I watched her sit down during our little break time. When we say hi, I walked up and just said hello again and asked her name. And she kind of, you could tell, stood back and said, my name is Sally. And I said, well, Sally, it's nice to have you. I said, listen, if you'd ever like to, I'd love to hear your story. And here's my email, here's a little card, and I'd love to have you share your story with me. So we began this dialogue. She began to write and tell me. Her father and mother divorced when she was very young. She used to go to her grandmother's house when she was 3 and roll cigarettes for her grandmother, and the grandmother would reward her with a little Dixie cup of Jack Daniels, 3 years old. She said, Mark, my mom's had so many different men coming through our door when I was growing up. I don't remember all the names. Then she began to share some of the stories of the abuse. And I would listen, and I would always write back a very thoughtful email, I realized this is a young person who never had a father, never had anyone who took a personal interest in the troubles and the traumas and the difficulties of their life, and never had anybody in life they felt they could trust to just talk to about. So little by little, she began to open up more and more and more. One day, she wrote to me. Yeah, it was pretty, and again, I let people be honest with me. You want to use a swear word, use a swear word, okay? You think the tax collectors and sinners that Jesus ate with use sanitized language? I'm sorry. You're gravely mistaken. So when people go through life, when they hit their finger with a hammer, they say, ouch. When their soul or their emotions get hit pretty hard, sometimes they say a word or two that isn't, it's an ouch. She wrote, she said, Mark, I'm just kind of at work today. I'm overwhelmed. I just can't stop crying. My horse died today. I've called two or three friends, and they all make fun of me. And my horse died. I've had this horse since I was about 10. Now, see, I get it, because let me explain something to you. Horses, if you're a horse person, they're way more personal than a dog. And I knew something, so here's what I wrote back. I said, Dear Sally, I'm heartbroken for you today that you lost what I am sure was the best friend you ever had in your life. Because you know what I know? When I was a kid, all I wanted was a horse. I wanted a horse. When you're on the back of that horse and your dad came home drunk or your mom brought another guy home, you know what you do? You go out, you saddle him up, and you ride him and you talk to him. Because a horse is the only one that listens. She wrote me back, I'm sitting here, Mark, I am stunned. You get it. That's exactly what would happen. I shared my horse, the guys who beat me up, the time I was raped, the time this happened. I'm talking to my horse, and today my horse died because someone neglected, they fed him too many oats. I get it. God gets it. But the only reason I did it is because I took the extra time, to put myself, and this is what I wanted to get to. I work my mind to imagine what it would be like to walk in their shoes, to experience what they have had to go through, and it's helped me greatly with empathy and greatly with compassion. I put myself, Jesus incarnated himself into what? A human form. So when I'm dealing with people on an individual basis, I try to put myself in their form. What would that have been like? You know, one of the things that right now, I mean, if I talk about it too long, I'll just melt into a puddle of tears. It can happen to me at home. You know what really tears at my heart? Really tears at my heart? Is the fatherlessness that so many young people are dealing with today. It can just undo me. Give me an example. So, when the Philando Castile thing happened here in the cities, I knew that and I got a letter here that a young lady from my church told me I could read. I knew whether the cops were guilty or not, or he was guilty or not. I just knew. In my heart, I knew for the black community, this is really difficult. This is really difficult. Now, I have my son's wife's sister. My son's wife's sister is a blonde cop in the roughest part of North Minneapolis and has been her entire career. So I know lots of backstory that would make the hairs on your neck stand up. I know things she's seen firsthand blow your mind. So one day, this particular was the day after I was going to a particular store that I go shop at regularly, one of the Trader Joe's in the city. And there's a guy, an African black man in there that I've gotten to know. We'll call him Jamal. And Jamal's just really outgoing. I can tell, here's what I could tell as I take in. He's had a couple gold teeth in front. He's a dad trying to take care of a couple kids. And he's trying really hard to make it. He's got a great attitude. So more than once, I walked up to him after I've purchased something. I said, hey, Jamal, I just want you to know something, man. You got a fantastic attitude. You just, I look forward to coming in here and seeing you every time. You try so hard to help him. And he looked at me, and this is what I knew. So this guy's about 30, right? He's big. He's bigger than I am. He looked at me, and I knew that I had just done something to this man no other man my age has ever done in his life, because I knew intuitively this guy had no dad. He said, "Wow, Mark, you know, no one's ever told me that before." I said, "Well, I'm telling you, and I know what I'm talking about. Your attitude, you're a tremendous young man. And you just keep doing what you're doing because it's going to pay off." And you could just tell he's just beaming. So now, I show up right when the store opens and I walk in. No one else is there. And I go over and I looked at him. I walked right up. I didn't get like in his personal space. But I said, "Jamal," I said it quietly. I said, "How are you this morning?" I said, "I know your community is really going through a difficult time right now." This guy just melted into tears. He goes, "This bunch of blankety blank shit, Mark. What are we, man? We just kill us? Do we have assignment or just kill us? Do we even matter?" And I said to him, he said, "Man, what do I tell my kids? What do I tell my kids, Mark?" So I looked at him. I got a little closer. I didn't put my hand on him, but I got closer and I said, "Jamal, I want to tell you something right now. You are giving your kids a gift that very few kids get today. You're coming into work every day, showing up. You're showing them there's another way to live. And you're giving them the security and the love that I know you never got yourself." And he just goes, "Damn, where did you come from? Like, I got chills right now all over my body, Mark. How do you know that?" I said, "Well, I just know. You probably didn't have a father." He goes, "I don't know my father, Mark." I said, "You're giving your kids the best gift that any man could give them. You stuck around. You're showing up every day, and you're trying to give them a better life." And he just said, "Can I hug you?" And I said, "Absolutely." So I grabbed him and hugged him. He wouldn't let go. Some other people are starting to come into this section of the store, and I didn't care. He goes, "Man, who are you?" I go, "I'm just a guy. But I'm a pastor." He goes, "Oh, I get it." He said, "I wonder, something's really unusual about you." He goes, "Man, I've never met anybody like you." I said, "Jamal, listen, you matter to God. You matter to God and you matter to me. And the world we live in is full of, you know what, poopy." I used a different word. "But you matter to God, Jamal." And I said, "Jamal, if there's anything I can ever, I work with young men. I care about young men. My own father left. I've raised 4 kids. I've got now 11 grandchildren. One of them's black." I said, "If I can ever help you, you let me know." Okay? So all it did was take time to notice. You see, take time to put myself in another person's shoes. We've got to learn, men and women, what it means. I want to read you this letter. So, I have a few, as I'm sure we all do. A young black sister coming to my church. She's very dear to me. She's very dear to me. So I reached out to my email and I just said, "Hey, kiddo, how you doing? How are you?" I didn't say a whole lot. I just wanted to open the door. "You can talk. I'm a safe place to talk to." Her own father is not a safe person to talk to. I'm going to take my glasses off a minute. "Mark, I'm doing okay. I'm really sad this is all happening. I'm sad that 2 men lost their lives 2 days in a row. I know cops have a difficult job and they're human too, but I don't think it had to end this way in either man. For either man. I've seen both videos. I'm sad that others feel this gives them a right to kill officers, but I'm afraid. I'm going to open up to you today about how I feel. I'm scared that evil actions of the snipers last night in Dallas will drown out 2 black men that also lost their lives. From the bottom of my heart, a cop is an honorable job. I've come to learn that more and more each day as I see what they face on a daily basis. I'm very sad that 5 officers had to die because of something evil and hatred. Someone's evil and hatred. I'm scared that someone will tie this to all those who are marching to stop police brutality. I'm scared those two black men will not get justice. I'm scared for my family and friends. I have a cousin, 115 pounds, max skinnier than I am. An officer broke her knee. A male officer broke her knee and gave her 3 stitches. No, she wasn't innocent, but she didn't deserve that. I have a friend who I love dearly in a workhouse, something like that. He's let out for work, and they pat him down when you return. The person that was supposed to pat him down left and left him there waiting. He spent the night sleeping on the floor. A superior found him on the floor and asked him what he was doing there. My friend told him the superior did nothing. My friend was there the whole night. I've had black and Latino family and friends patted down, searched, woken in the middle of the night, taken out of their house, treated terribly by police. People being treated that way don't feel safe. They feel powerless. There's nothing you can do. I don't tie this to all police officers, Mark. They have a hard job, and I know that. But I don't know if people know how often these things happen that I've described. How they've been happening for years. How people have rules that they give their kids. Rules they pass on because they don't want their child to be shot or killed by a cop. It all varies depending on who you ask. And, of course, there are plenty of traffic stops that end beautifully, in a peaceful way, with many officers treating civilians in a loving and honorable way. But even I have a certain set of rules that I follow. And it's times like this that make me very aware of the color of my skin, of ugly history, of ugly experiences in my own life. I have to fight to believe that I matter. I have to fight to believe that my life is also valuable. I'm scared that I won't see change, that they'll dismiss the deaths of two black men under the banner of war on police or black on black crime or something else they say people of color should be focusing on, something very they deem more prevalent than the deaths of two black men and many before them. I'm scared that they'll not charge the officers involved, and it will continue while we continue to endure it, living by a separate set of rules. Others turn their head or excuse it away or say there had to be something they did to be treated that way, because whether it's brought up at times like this or not, whether it's talked about in times of perceived peace, I still carry the burden, and so do many others. It just gets heavier in times like this or times when I feel discriminated against. This is how I feel. I hope it doesn't offend you. I hope you can try to understand what I'm carrying right now. That's why I think it's important to pray for the church at times like this. God has taught me that everyone thinks their pain is so righteous that they believe is right and that God is on their side when God sees what we can't about each other. And God has really challenged me to love brothers and sisters whose opinions on this have been wounding at times when it feels unfair to love them, when I want to retreat to what I know God calls me back out again. This issue Satan uses to ruin us. I'm not sure how to fix it, but I look to the Bible. I love this young lady, and God is working in wonderful ways in her life. I was not offended in the least that she wrote that to me, and I wrote her back. I believe she would attest a very tender email and affirm to her that she does indeed matter and she matters to me, and I really appreciated that she took the time to share with me her life experience. 2 days later, I was in this room with 50 police officers in this room at the wedding of the young blonde police officer from my church, whose family, who's a cop in North Minneapolis. In the room were smatterings of a variety of different races. I took the time during that time, because it was during the middle of all the turmoil that was going on in the city with that shooting, to thank the officers for laying their life on the line, because they do. I have letters from officers at home. We have a group of our kids. What we did was we had them make cookies and color pictures and send them to some of the cops who were literally, their homes were being circled. They were having unbelievable things said to them during this time. I'm not saying one more right than the other. I'm saying they both need understanding and compassion. One officer wrote me, I have the email at home. He said, I'm sitting here at my desk in tears, Mark, what we're going through right now. This is not what I signed up for. I'm not that kind of officer. The notes that the kids wrote were a big deal to us. After the wedding, I went through the aisle myself and shook the hand of every African-American person in the auditorium that day, looked them in the eye, and said, I'm touched that you came today, and I'm sorry for what your community is going through right now. What does it take to decide to get out of ourselves and walk in the shoes of other people and try to be like Jesus Christ? And try to be like Jesus Christ. No matter what the color of a person's skin, everybody's gone through life-shaping events in their life. And we want to be like Jesus, to learn to listen to those things. They need our understanding, and this is how we get close to one another. You follow me? Okay, I have more I'd like to share, but here's what I would like you to do now. And this is going to take courage. I would like to ask you to do this, and I want to everybody to know that what you share with the person that you're going to talk to here now is confidential. It's confidential. So I would like you to get in groups of two, and I'd like it not to be your spouse, because generally they know you already. And I would like you to share with that person that you're sitting with the most difficult thing that you have gone through personally in the last 12 years. What was the most difficult thing that you have gone through in your life in the last 12 years? I'd just like you to share your story with them. And we're going to take 30 minutes for this, then we're going to get back together and wrap up and let you go. Okay, so you can go to different places in the room. You can talk quiet. But here's what I want you to do, okay? Listen very carefully to this, because I got to read you how this will work, how this exercise will work. Let me get my little Northlands regional plan, you see? You don't think I'm linear, but it's in there somewhere. I'm linear in a non-linear sort of way. I want each of you to share with each one the most difficult thing you've gone through in the last 12 years. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to really put yourself in the other person's shoes as they share their story. I want you to imagine what it would have been like to go through what they are sharing with you, what they did, to experience what they went through. I want you to try to feel what that would have been like. Do this without rushing to make judgments on their story or their experience. I want you to enter their experience and think of how God would respond, of God's great compassion and God's tenderheartedness towards them. That's what I want you to do. Okay? So, please get with someone. It doesn't have to be a total stranger, but if you're married, I'd like you to try to do it with someone else so you can each share, you know, some story. Last 12 years, one of the most, you get a choice, but one of the most difficult things you've been through, and share it with that person. You'll each have about 15 minutes because we're going to go for 30 minutes. So ready? Go.